Wake up. It's Sleep Unplugged with Dr. Chris Winter, episode 19, Nightmares and Night Terrors. Whatever you do, don't fall asleep. Happy Halloween, everybody. This is Dr. Chris Winter. Welcome to episode 19 about nightmares and night terrors. Of course, that was the theme music from Nightmare on Elm Street, classic from when I was growing up. That was one of the that and the Friday the 13th series were the epitomes of horror. Interesting, like right now, I think at the top of the box office or near the top is Terrifier 2, which I know nothing about. All I know is if you don't see Terrifier 1, you'll never be able to follow the plot of Terrifier 2. So make sure you do your reading on Terrifier 1 before you see Terrifier 2. Or you'll be completely lost with the plot of that one, I'm sure. So welcome. This is exciting. This is episode 19. This is our Halloween edition. Happy Halloween to everybody out there. Really excited to be with you, be a part of this today. This is a really interesting topic we're going to talk about, and really excited to kind of dive into it. And clear up some misperceptions about nightmares and night terrors and what we can do to solve them if we're dealing with them. As we typically do with the show, I want to introduce myself, Dr. Chris Winter, I'm a neurologist sleep specialist. You can DM the show or DM me. Follow me at Dr. Chris Winter on Twitter, Dr. Chris Winter Instagram, Dr. Chris Winter TikTok. My books are The Sleep Solution, Why Your Sleep's Broken and How to Fix It, as well as The Rested Child, Why You're Tired, Wired, or Irritable Child May Have a Sleep Disorder, and How to Help. There is a YouTube channel for this podcast and where you can actually see my Halloween costume. I won't spoil it for you. You have to go to the YouTube channel to see it. I think that's called a tease. And I usually put the hashtag Sleep Unplugged Extras to sort of add color to our podcast. So if we refer to, you know, studies or movies like Terrifier 2, I may put some information and some further reading and things to explore. You can always find them with hashtag Sleep Unplugged Extras. Before we begin our show, we usually start with comments, corrections, feedback. And I got a great one this week about last week's episode, episode 18 on daylight saving time, from Dr. Karen Johnson, who is a neurologist and friend and sleep peep from UMass Bay State. She's the director of sleep up there, neurologist, neurology professor, also very influential in terms of women in medicine and women in sleep. And she's just outstanding and a real advocate for the abolishment of the daylight saving time and adopting standard time. You can find her on Twitter at Dr. Sleepy Karen. That's DrSleepyKarin. So make sure you spell it right. She's always got a smile on her face. I challenge anybody to find a picture of her not happy. And she basically wrote and said, and you can find the tweet, I retweeted it on my page, Dr. Chris Winter, that, hey, you're comparing in the last episode a 1 hour time zone change, like flying from New York to St. Louis with daylight saving time. And that's not a great comparison. And she's right. I made the comment in the last episode about, yes, when we transition from daylight saving time, when we fall back or spring forward, typically when we lose the hour, there are a lot of car crashes in that week after. There are heart attacks. There's all kinds of negative things that happen when we make that adjustment. And I commented that it's not just with that initial adjustment that there is research that shows that when we're on daylight saving time, not standard time, that that misalignment that we have for the next several months with daylight and our wake and sleep activities, that that alone causes risk and medical harm. Different than a 1 hour trip to St. Louis, even if you stay in St. Louis for a while, because yes, in that 1 hour trip, you gain or lose an hour. But when you arrive in St. Louis and look up in the sky at noon, when it says noon on your watch, you're going to see the sun there just like you would if you were in New York City. So even though you're shifting an hour, it's not changing the relationship between sunlight and time of day. And that's different than when we transition to daylight saving time, that when you look up in the sky at noon during daylight saving time, during standard time, it's different, right? And that's the whole reason for time zones. We want to make sure that no matter where we are in this great world, when we look up at a certain time of day, the sun's in a relatively similar position there than it is 6 p.m., 3 a.m., whatever the time, somewhere else in the world. So that's the whole point. And her point was, Chris, you're diminishing the daylight saving time problem when you compare it to a one-hour trip, because one-hour trip, seven-hour trip, 12-hour trip, when you arrive and you make that adjustment in time, the daylight that your eyes are seeing and that your body and brain are experiencing is about the same as it was where you came from. That's not the case with daylight saving time, that we're skewing the timing of light. So I appreciate that, Karen. I really do. And I love it when people write into the show. I'm touched and honored that she would even be listening to the show, let alone adding some really valuable information to it. Thank you very much, Karen Johnson. So let's talk about nightmares and dive into nightmares and night terrors. Nightmare, we talked about a bit from the episode 16, sleep paralysis. We got into a little bit about the origin of the word nightmare. Mare, the old English word meaning witch, demon, hag, really has nothing to do with the contemporary English word mare, meaning a female horse, although it's often depicted that way in more recent art depictions of, you know, demons and nightmares and things like that. So that's where the word comes from. And there is a differentiation I want to make between a nightmare and a bad dream. Nightmare is typically an awakening from sleep where you're upset, anxious, heart racing, and you had this terrible sequence of images that were stressful, cruel, anxiety provoking, versus a bad dream where there's not really that awakening from sleep. It's sort of the next day when you're talking to your friends, like, man, I had a really bad dream last night, but I didn't really wake up that I'm aware of in my sleep, you know, panicky, sweaty, having difficulty getting back to sleep. So that's sort of the differentiation between the nightmare and the bad dream. Generally speaking, nightmares have a bit of a story to them. I was walking through a door into the woods, and when I turned around, the doorway was gone, and I was lost in the woods, and I was scared. I couldn't get back to my kids, and there were clearly animals that were chasing me in the woods. Like, there's a narrative to it, not always, but often. And that really brings us to a big differentiation between nightmares and night terrors we'll get into right off the bat, which is, generally speaking, nightmares or abnormal awakenings and dream sequences from REM sleep, which I will interchange with the term dream sleep. Although, as we've talked in previous episodes, you can dream in stages outside of REM sleep. Versus the night terror is something that's arising from something that's not REM related. And that's really important, because as we're talking about nightmares, what's the difference between an individual having an isolated nightmare, which we all, many of us, tend to have from time to time, versus somebody who's so stricken by having nightmares so frequently that it's becoming problematic? It's creating a lot of anxiety about sleep. It's creating or perpetuating insomnia. So that's sort of the difference between having a headache every now and then and sort of a chronic migraine disorder. Or when you were young, you had a febrile seizure once when you had a fever and stayed up too late, never had one again, versus somebody with epilepsy who's constantly having seizures. So the syndrome of having lots of nightmares to the point where it's becoming problematic and you want to do something about it, that is nightmare disorder. And it belongs in the category of parasomnias, but because you guys are so advanced here on Sleep Unplugged, that we're going to differentiate that in terms of a REM sleep parasomnia, which is what nightmare disorder is, versus a non-REM sleep parasomnia, which is night terrors. And we'll get to go to those in a minute. So I'll put on, as a Sleep Unplugged extra, once again, that sort of map of sleep that differentiates REM sleep from non-REM sleep. Once again, we get most of our non-REM or deep sleep right at the beginning of our night. And as the night goes, we have less and less deep sleep or N3 sleep, much more REM sleep. So if you divide the night in half, a lot more nightmare disorder at the back end of sleep, a lot more night terrors in the front end of sleep. So when we think about non-REM parasomnias, we think about the night terrors. When we think about REM-related parasomnias, that's nightmare disorder. There are other REM-related parasomnias, and if you're a listener of the show, you already know about one of them, which is isolated sleep paralysis. That was episode 16. So if you're having isolated events of sleep paralysis, that's considered a REM-related parasomnia. The other one that we often talk about is REM behavior disorder. These are individuals who lose that paralysis that we're supposed to experience in REM sleep, and now they're free to sort of act out their dreams. That's considered a REM-related parasomnia. The other one is catathrenia, when people moan in their sleep. I do this from time to time. My wife loves it. It really helps her sleep well at night, I can assure you. We'll talk a little bit about that because that's a very interesting and common REM-related parasomnia that people don't really talk about. The last one is sleep-related painful erections. We'll skip that one for now, as the title is pretty descriptive of what that would be. When we think about nightmare disorder, it's often seen, nightmares are often seen in kids and become a little bit less frequent as you get into adulthood. Not as much as night terrors, as we'll talk about. It's thought that probably 20 to 30% of kids have, fairly frequent nightmares. Less so with adults, but those numbers are a little bit skewed. Probably somewhere in the 10, 8 to 10% prevalence when you're thinking about adults. But a lot of adults have nightmares, just not enough that would they would consider it typically a disorder. What are the risk factors for nightmare disorder? Stress and psychological state is a big one, PTSD in particular. When you look at individuals who have PTSD, about 80% of those individuals are going to have frequent and problematic nightmares. So the relationship works one direction. If you have PTSD, very likely to have nightmares. It doesn't work as well in the opposite direction. If you have nightmares, therefore you're much more likely to have PTSD. That would really not be the case. Eating, particularly eating late at night, eating certain kinds of foods, spicy foods, caffeinated foods, heavy meals has been associated with nightmares. Discomfort and pain. So eating enough where you're in discomfort and pain would be a double whammy, but just anything that's causing problems, arthritis, neuropathy are two very common ones, or just sleeping in uncomfortable situations. Always think about camping or sleeping on a hotel mattress that isn't very comfortable. Anything that kind of throws that typical environment off can be a nidus for a nightmare disorder. Medications and substance abuse. Most common medications, some cholesterol medications can do it. Antidepressants, Paxil comes to mind, but there are many others. Sleep aids, ironically, can do it. Ambien's a big one. When you think about a lot of times we're using sleep aids to treat this disorder. Hey, doc, I'm waking up having nightmares a lot. Oh, here, just take a sleeping pill. That'll help you. That often throws a little bit of gasoline on the fire. So we want to avoid doing that. Beta blockers, which are commonly used for things like blood pressure or migraine prevention, can certainly do it. Antidepressants, Parkinson's disease medications can do it. And when you think about Parkinson's disease medications, it's kind of interesting in the sense that with Parkinson's medications, we're giving medications to enhance or raise dopamine levels in the brain. And when we get to medications that are used to treat nightmare disorder, one of the class of drugs that we use are drugs that actually block dopamine. We'll talk about those in just a minute. And then anti-malarial drugs, which is another very interesting classification or group of drugs that can cause this. In fact, most people or many people who take anti-malarial drugs will tell you they have really bizarre, vivid dreams, not necessarily negative or nightmares, but a lot of people tend to do that. In fact, there are several publicized lawsuits that I'm aware of where soldiers who were forced to take anti-malarial drugs based upon where they were serving sued because they had nightmare disorder after they took the malarial. Even when they were done with the course of anti-malarials, continued to have problems with nightmares, which is an interesting mechanism. And again, we talked a little bit about in the episode on sleep paralysis, that idea of amygdala activation, fear, loathing, dread, anxiety. If you If you increase that, you can actually change sometimes the nature, not only of the dreaming, but sometimes of the paralysis and things like that that go along with it, which can make the cycle even worse. Sleep apnea, I have always associated with not only frequent dreaming, but also nightmares. There have been some studies that say no, that there isn't an increased relationship in nightmares and sleep apnea. In fact, there's a in the Wikipedia entry on nightmares, it kind of definitively says that, you know, nightmares are not associated with sleep apnea. I think that's not true at all. There was a, and what they're referring to is there was a couple studies that sort of called that into question. There's a, they were from 2006. There was a more recent study in Frontiers of Neurology in 2019 that said, no, there's, you know, we've reviewed the literature. There's definitely a relationship between sleep disordered breathing, like sleep apnea and nightmares, but there might be a bit of an inverse relationship, meaning you might be more likely to have the nightmares with milder sleep apnea than with more severe sleep apnea. And if we think about that mechanism, it might make sense. And if you think about sleep apnea, we've talked about this in previous episodes, episode 5, where we talked about mild sleep apnea. Sleep apnea, you can breathe or you can sleep, but you're having difficulty doing both at the same time because your upper airway is unstable. Now, when we dream, we go into REM sleep, we're paralyzed. So imagine an individual going into REM sleep, about to have a dream, and as they're going into REM sleep and experience that paralysis, their airway is collapsing. It's harder and harder for them to breathe in REM sleep, which is why a lot of times when you talk to people who are having sleep apnea and that breathing disturbance, they often feel like they're suffocating or drowning. That's the nature, the theme of their dream. So imagine as that sleep apnea gets worse and worse, that individual's brain may be deciding, look, it's not worth it to dream, because with that paralysis, it's making it so difficult to breathe. Your brain is always going to prioritize oxygen over dreaming. So what you often find is when you talk to individuals, they go through it, they get through a sort of a continuum of, yeah, I was not really a dreamer. And then as I developed sleep apnea, I was dreaming a lot. But as the sleep apnea got worse and worse, I stopped dreaming again, went back to not dreaming. Well, initially you were dreaming, you just may not be remembering it. Then you started having difficulty maintaining your sleep because of the REM-related paralysis. So you're waking up and experiencing your dreams. But now as the sleep apnea is getting worse and worse, your brain is actually cutting REM sleep out. So when I look at sleep studies, which I do almost every day, when you look at the truly bad sleep apnea patients, they often don't have a lot of REM sleep, because as soon as they even creep up to approaching that REM sleep and that paralysis is happening, their airway is closing so strongly, they can't breathe. So their brain is almost like saying, look, it's not worth it to dream anymore. We'll just skip that so we can have a chance of breathing. So that may be a really reason for that inverse relationship with sleep apnea. So one of the things we always look for in individuals who are describing a lot of dreaming or a lot of nightmares is, could you have sleep apnea? So sleep studies can often be helpful in that. How do we treat it? You know, it always jumps to right to psychological analysis. If we can just get the individual to not have so much fear and anxiety, we can actually make their nightmares better, maybe. It's certainly fine to start there. For a lot of people, particularly with PTSD, there becomes a degree of desensitization. We're trying to get that individual to not fear going to sleep, not fear having that recurring dream. Easier said than done. And this often goes along with what we often call storyline alteration. Some people call it image rehearsal therapy, where you're having this dream of drowning constantly, or more of a PTSD situation. You are an active duty military person and you experience something awful, and now you relive it in your dream. And so what some people will do is say, look, I want you to consciously revisit this dream that you're having, you know, prior to going to bed, and I want you to experience it in as much detail as you can, and then I want you to change the ending. So you're walking home, and instead of the attack happening, the person jumps out and tries to grab you, and you punch them in the face, and they fall over unconscious, and you run away. That's the image, that's the ending I want you to rehearse. And that becomes very important. Even with things that are less trivial, you were a pitcher with a baseball team and you made a bad pitch and they hit a home run and you lost the game. Maybe what I want you to do when you go to bed is envision that scene one more time. But in this time, you don't miss with your pitch. You throw it exactly where you want it. That batter swings and misses it. And instead of giving up the home run, you strike him out and win the game. I want you to envision yourself doing that. That really helps a lot of people get past the negative feelings that come along with it and often the dreams that go along with it. And speaking of baseball, congratulations again to the Phillies for winning game one of the World Series in Houston, and hopefully will deliver on a World Series victory. So that trauma can come in all different shapes and sizes. A really interesting extension of that image rehearsal therapy you can see in a Swiss study that was just published, became very popular in the media. It was headlines, "Can you cure nightmares with a single piano chord?" So what this woman, Sophie Schwartz, did, she was a researcher in Geneva, is she paired that image rehearsal therapy with a sound or a cue and called it targeted memory reactivation. So as the individual is sitting there experiencing purposefully the negative dream or nightmare that they're recurring, that's recurring, she pairs it with a piano chord. And so, for instance, I'll play you a piano chord. So it was a single piano chord, but for some of you listening to that, I'm guessing that is triggering an emotion in you. It definitely triggers one in me. That is that is a piano piece, Musica Ricercata, movement number two, is by a composer, Ligeti. It was featured in the Eyes Wide Shut soundtrack. And if you remember that scene when that was playing, I found that to be one of the most terrifying Kubrick scenes ever. And so whenever I hear that, it reminds me of something really negative. There's a similar sort of simple piano piece that Kubrick used right before The Shining, which, if you're a fan of the show, you know I'm fascinated by Kubrick and his movies, particularly The Shining. The sequel was Dr. Sleep, of course. So she's using a piano sequence played while the individual is rehearsing that positive out ending to her nightmare. And then when the individuals would sleep, they would be monitored with electrodes on their head. When they would go into REM sleep, that same piano sequence would play, hopefully targeting or triggering that positive memory. And she found in her study that when that therapy was used, it really significantly reduced the incidence of nightmare disorder in these individuals. So again, that's the targeted memory reactivation. Outside of that, there are medications. We talked just a minute ago about Parkinson's disease and the drugs we use for Parkinson's that elevate dopamine as potentially causing more nightmares. There's a medication called risperidone that blocks dopamine that can actually be helpful for some individuals, as well as a drug called trazosin. I'm sorry, not trazosin, prazosin, which is an alpha-1 blocker, which a lot of individuals use with PTSD to help with that as well too. You're sort of ratcheting down that anxiety response. And a lot of times, if you use these drugs sooner than later, the response and effectiveness can be better, meaning you haven't created that anxiety response yet. That has to be somewhat rehearsed for those nightmares to truly kind of get embedded. Simple things that we can do, a regular sleep routine, things that reduce stress, talking about the dream, normalizing the dream, all of these things can be very helpful. So let's quickly switch gears from nightmare disorder to night terrors. We're going from REM sleep into non-REM sleep. Remember, we divide non-REM sleep into N1, N2, N3 sleep. N1 transitional sleep, N2 sleep is light sleep, N3 is deep sleep. Most of these are happening during deep sleep or N3 sleep. There are other non-REM parasomnias. We're talking about night terrors. There's also confusional arousals. These are arousals you often see in children. You can see them in adults, where a child wakes up, looks around, rubs their face, motions to somebody who's not there, and immediately returns to sleep without that intense, anxious, upset arousal with sympathetic activation all over the place that happens with night terrors. There's also a somniloquy, which is sleep talking. somnambulism, which is sleepwalking, sleepy sex, where individuals are engaged in sexual related activities, and then sleep related eating disorder, where people get up, eat things, go back to bed. The hallmark of these non-REM parasomnias is, generally speaking, there is zero memory of what happened. Talking to somebody, remember last night when you woke up and had that nightmare? Oh God, yes, I remember. I thought there were wolves in the bedroom and I was trying to fight them off. That's more of a REM-related phenomenon versus the non-REM-related phenomenon. You woke up and you were screaming and I was having trouble getting you back in bed. Do you remember doing that? No, I really don't. There is no memory. In fact, I'm actually serving as an expert witness right now in a trial related to sleep-related sexual activity that's truly bizarre, that happened, where an individual woke up in a foreign place, walked over, inappropriately touched somebody. The person said, "Hey, what are you doing? Go away." And the person said, "Okay," and walked away, went back to sleep where they were sleeping, and had no recollection of it the next day when the authorities arrived. So these are very important disorders to be aware of because they can cause all kinds of problems, even outside of the health-related field that, you know, that we typically talk about. These are less common. Night terrors are much less common than nightmares, and they typically go away much, you know, more quickly as an individual gets older. So you are more likely to see them with young kids. As people get older, they tend to disappear a little bit better. What are the things that tend to increase the frequency of night terrors? Disturbed, inadequate sleep. Certainly travel, taking somebody across time zones. We've talked about how disruptive that can be to disrupting circadian rhythms, which we talked about in episode 14. Medications can do it, illnesses, fever. So a lot of times when kids are sick, they're more likely to have these types of events than if they're are well and sleeping well. With psychological associations, they are there. They are much more likely to be associated with psychological maladies and diagnoses in adults versus kids. So if your child is having sleep terrors, very unlikely that that's necessarily related to some psychological problem. If adults are dealing with night terrors, there is a much stronger association. Night terrors have also been associated with metabolic conditions like, you know, blood sugar dropping at night, as well as an inherited form, where we always, you know, sleep doctors are always asking, you know, patients who sleep-related eating disorder or bedwetting or sleepwalking, sleep talking, or night terrors, hey, did your parents have those, you know, as a kid? Or do you have siblings that had night terrors? Because you often see, did your parents ever describe that? Because you often see inherited forms sort of transmitted, you know, to other generations. What are the treatments? The big treatment we always hear about is don't wake up a sleepwalker. Don't wake up somebody having a night terror. And there's a little truth to that. I've always heard weird things about what happens if you wake them up. They can die. They could, you know, be stuck in a sleep related trance the rest of their life. Like if you make those funny faces, you know, don't make that face, your face might freeze that way. I've heard similar things about night terrors. The two big things about night terrors and waking people up in them is, number one, they're confused. They're often terrified, thinking they're defending themselves against something that's dangerous or evil. So to suddenly wake them up or to be really, you know, loud, wake up, and shaking them, they often perceive you as the threat. So there are many instances of people getting hurt, not only the patient getting hurt, but the waker getting hurt, trying to vigorously wake somebody out of a night terror. The second thing is that confrontation, that stimulus can make the night terror go on longer. So it's generally, you're just trying to ease somebody back into a situation where they're not leaving the bedroom, ease them back into bed, kind of go along with it, and be calming and soothing as you do it is generally the best way to make that better. Making sure sleep environments are comfortable, making sure there's no stimulus for waking up. And then once, like we talked about with nightmares, with night terrors, it's also very important to look for underlying causes of sleep disorders, because they certainly can be there in individuals with night terrors, just like nightmares. So sometimes a sleep study in an individual who's constantly awakening with night terrors can be very helpful. because there's often something intrinsic to their sleep that's waking them up. You know, we were taught in our sleep fellowship that one way to sort of deal with night terrors as an initial step is if you're a parent of maybe a child who's having a lot of night terrors, you put them to bed. And then very soon after you go to bed, you want to wake them up. Because anybody who's ever dealt with night terrors knows, I've got three kids and my youngest had night terrors. We'd put him to bed and go back downstairs and, you know, watch a TV show. And it seemed like as soon as I sat down, the night terrors started to happen, screaming. In fact, the first thought was always, oh, there's a squirrel in his bedroom or something. Like, there's no way he's gotten into bed, gone to sleep, and is now waking up screaming. So it was always a shock to go in there and see him already asleep having this night terror. So one of the strategies that we employ that sometimes works is you put the child who has the night terrors down, you leave, and then soon after come back into the bedroom and, you know, gently scratch your son or daughter's back or pat their head just until they start to kind of rouse or move around the bed where you know, oh, he's moving around and switching positions, so he's arousing from sleep. And then that was it. We would leave, shut the door. And sometimes creating that arousal right before they go to bed yourself, instead of letting the night terror do it, would sometimes help. It was really helpful for our son to kind of break those cycles. So that's it. If you're interested in more information about these kinds of phenomena, I'm going to direct you to an unusual book that was just released in October by Alice Vernon. She is a professor, and I'm going to butcher this, at Aberystwyth University. That's a university, I believe, in, God, I think it's Wales, but forgive me if it's not. I know it's somewhere in that vicinity. But Alice wrote a book called Night Terrors, Troubled Sleep and the Stories We Tell About It. So if you're interested in this topic, she's a creative writing professor or teacher. If you're interested in the topic, if you liked the episode and sort of the strangeness and the lore of sleep paralysis, you might want to check that book out. I think it would be a very interesting read. And you can follow her on Twitter as well too. So that's it. I want to give a shout out to Michelle Rudderman at the Philadelphia Inquirer. She wrote an article recently about sleeping, if you're a Phillies fan, during the World Series, and she mentioned the Sleep Unplugged podcast, so she's automatically a friend of the show. So now in the last week, I think the show has been mentioned in the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer, so that's pretty great. So I really appreciate the shout out about that. So really appreciate you listening to the show, especially since you've got all kinds of great Halloween plans I'm sure that you've made. Follow me on Dr. Chris Winter, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. Please like, subscribe to, rate, and if you have the time, review the show. Really appreciate it. You've taken this completely obscure show, and I think at one point we were like the 37th or 39th rated podcast, medical podcast in the United States, which is shocking. And it's all because of you guys and the feedback and the tweaking to make this show better and better. So if you have ideas for that, let me know. That's it. I hope you have wonderful dreams, no nightmares, night terrors this Halloween. Until we have our next episode, sleep well.